Well, good morning, everybody. A bit to my surprise, actually, this being a Microsoft conference, there's a room full of people, and there's not a line of code on my desk. So I don't have any code to show. So if you want to see code, you have to go somewhere else. The only code is on my T-shirt, actually, so on my shirt of tea, actually. But I am a developer, don't worry. But I'm not going to talk about code today. I'm going to talk about Agile. I'm going to talk a bit about, after having done Agile projects for like 2 decades or something, what I learned from that. Actually, it's a lot more than I can put on a 45-minute slide deck. So this is actually a 90-minute talk. So be warned, you'll miss lunch. No, sorry, I'm sort of having a bad reputation for not ending on time, so please bear with me. I'll try to do it as fast as possible. So who am I, for those of you who don't know me? My name is Sander. I'm basically a dad. So I have 3 kids. One of them is living in Budapest. The other 2 are living with me and their mom, part of the time, actually. So in the rest of my time, I'm basically a software architect, a programmer, an agile coach, stuff like that. I have my own company, so I'm an independent. And I used to work until like 4 weeks ago as a CTO and lead software architect for this particular insurance company, which I'll not mention. Before that, I worked for Capgemini for a very, very long time. I also used to be a member of the Partner Advisory Council for the .NET. This is my website, my Twitter tag, if you feel the need to tweet. If you have any questions, please email me or just tweet me and I'll try to answer most of the questions right after the talk, right? So tweeting is probably faster than emailing. As I said, I used to be the CTO of this company. I'll talk a lot about this company during the talk. And I'll do one commercial sentence, is that if you are in need of a very good software architect, please phone me. No, that sounds rubbish. So I've written a couple of books, actually one on UML in 2003 and one on Agile. I've written a book on Agile before, but it's not in stores anymore. So this is the English edition. It has 2 chapters more, but this is the Dutch edition if you're able to read that. And if you like to do it more difficult, you can read the German edition, which is a lot thicker, of course, because they have much longer words than we have. So basically, to prove that to you that I'm a programmer as well, I'll give you one example of that. I was in this project where we were writing a web front end in ASP.NET MVC for a large government body, and it was sitting on top of COBOL, and I was writing some JavaScript to see if we could disable people from moving away from the page as soon as they typed in something. And then, of course, the project manager came to me, and he said, can I do a demo at the CEO of the client? And I said, sure, why not? But be aware, there's untested code in there, and I have some message boxes popping up, some alerts maybe, and he said, okay, I can do that. And after an hour, he gave me this screen grab, and he said, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. So this is my code, right? Untested code. Anyway, let's talk about waterfall first. I'm going to ask you a nasty question. Is anybody of you still in a waterfall or waterfall-style project? Nobody? Oh, there's a few of you there to admit. Oh, please listen to what I have to say, because you shouldn't be doing waterfall anymore. We shouldn't have done it ever, but anyway, so I'll tell you why. So, this is a white paper that was published in 1970. So probably before most of you were born. I'm an old guy, so I was there, I was 3. It's called Managing the Development of Large Software Systems, written by a guy called Winston Royce. Now, Winston Royce was sort of chief software engineer, something like that, for Lockheed, the airplane builder. And he wrote this particular white paper. Now, in this white paper, there's a picture you all know, and that's this one. You've seen this one, right? Has anybody never seen this one before? Then you're either too young or too old, I guess. But this is one of the defining pictures in our field, actually. So what it says, basically, it says, first you do requirements, then you do some analysis, then you do design, then you code, then you test, and then you put it into operations. Now, you all know where this goes wrong, right? Well, basically everywhere, but it starts off going wrong right here, because on a project, and you have to imagine that this looks like a single pass model, right? So every time you finish one of these stages, you go to the next one, and you never go back to where you were before, right? And basically, if you start doing the requirements on such a project, they have to be complete at the end of that stage. And that is extremely difficult, because as we all know, requirements change, right? On an average project, whether that's waterfall or agile or beyond agile or continuous delivery, doesn't really matter. requirements change somewhere between 20 and 25% during the course of the project. That is a lot, right? That means if you start working on requirements and you have to be complete and everything has to be in there until full level of detail. Now I've seen projects that actually create a full-blown data model during the requirement stage. Now, if there's one thing you know, is that it will change, right? And the problem is, people don't finish. So as long as you keep writing requirements and eat up all the time in the project, things will get delayed for the rest of the project, right? So the problem with this model is, when are you done with a particular phase? And the answer is, never. Because you're never done writing requirements, right? On any project whatsoever, you are never done writing requirements. Now the next problem is testing. Now I suppose none of you is a tester, right, in the audience? Is anybody a real actual tester? Oh, good. Hang in there. The problem is this. As a tester, you should know what this is, right? This is called Beam's Law. It's written down by a guy called Barry Beam, and Barry Beam said, you know what? On a project, especially when it's waterfall, the more time you spend in the project, the more effort it takes to resolve a bug. And that's not linear, that's exponential. That means if you postpone testing till the end of the project, after you finish all of your coding, it is very expensive to repair bugs. I'll give you one example of that. I was in this project way, way back, right? It was a desktop application when we still did that in the 90s. And this very good architect actually figured out, it wasn't me actually, but so he figured out that we could actually, on this desktop application, fire off all of the validations and the business rules and whatever, and do that dynamically after somebody moves away from one field and moves to the next field. And we built that, and it looked great. So it worked on our machines, right? And we had brilliant machines. We had the most powerful machines as developers that you could have at that point in time. And they had a processor in it called the 80386. You never heard of it, right? It ran at a speed of 33 megahertz. And that was extremely fast that day, right? So, and then the testers came along here, right? So we were done building after a year and a half in the project. And they started testing it, and they had the same PCs, because it was a desktop application run, so it ran on their PCs, as the end users had. And they had a different processor. They had an 8086. You don't know what it is, right? It's like, look it up on Wikipedia or whatever. But and it had this incredible speed of 4.77 megahertz. But there was a turbo button on it. Now, don't laugh. It's actually true. It's I had this PC, and it had a red turbo button on it. You could press it if you want to play games. And then it ran at 8 megahertz. It was still too slow. So what happened is the users of that application, or the testers actually, they started testing, and this was a data entry application, right, for insurance policies. And they typed in some value in some field, and they pressed tab and moved to the next field. It took 3 seconds. Every time they moved to the next field. And then the tester said, this is crap, guys. You shouldn't have built it like this. So all of these dynamic triggered business rules and whatever this architect had came up with, we had to get rid of it. Took us half a year to repair it. Right? So that's Beam's Law for you. And now, the interesting part is that in this white paper written in 1970, so you could say Winston Royce, with this picture 2 slides back, has become the father of the waterfall model. And the funny thing is, in this white paper, you should read it, it's actually quite good. You should read it. He says, please don't do this. It's actually, just read it. It's actually there, right? He basically says, you have to be able to go back to a stage before you are now in and change stuff and then move forward again. And he says, if you're lucky, it says here, right, hopefully the iterative interaction between the various phases is confined to successive steps. He says, hopefully you don't have to go back all the way, but it might happen. So in the same white paper, 1970, he actually says, don't use the waterfall model. He doesn't even use the word waterfall, because the fact that it looks like a waterfall was basically due to the fact that the text editors at that point in time, in 1970, could not get 7 boxes on a row. They didn't use Bootstrap back then, right? So anyway, so he says you have to be able to go back. And that is very much what Agile is about these days, right? It is about going back, learning about what you're doing, and improving on that. So basically, instead of being the father of the waterfall model, he should have been sort of like the great-great-great-grandfather, father of Agile, or anything that's in between. And he never became that, and he was very, well, he was a bit depressed about it, and his son was too, and et cetera, et cetera, and it stayed in the family for a long time, but actually this white paper was really good, and waterfall should have never existed. Instead, it have cost us millions and billions and billions of euros and dollars and whatever in failing software projects, basically because they got too big, because they couldn't test it, and basically because none of these stages actually finished on time. So if you are still doing waterfall, get out of there, please. Find a different job, kill the project manager or the client, whatever you do, but get out of there. So to give you one more quote, basically Winston Roy says, note that it is simply the entire process done in miniature to a time scale that is relatively small with respect to the overall effort. He is actually describing the way Agile works. Now, isn't that cool? So for those of you who are not in a waterfall project, you must be in an Agile project, right? Who of you is a certified Scrum Master, for instance? Oh, God. Get a life. No. Well, I'll explain to you why I say that. So the thing is, most of you will be doing Agile right now, right? And that makes me wonder why this room is so full. You should all know how Agile works, right? It's pretty easy, actually. You can do it. It's not that difficult, so why are you here? Well, maybe because if you have been doing Agile for a while, you see that it is also not the silver bullet. It is not the approach that will solve all your problems, nor is the Scrum Master you've hired, or the Agile coach, or whatever, or the project manager. Yeah. So basically for a long time, so I've been doing Agile since like the mid-90s. I started writing on an Agile approach when I still worked at Ordina, and it was like mid-90s, it was called SMART. And it had the same principles as any of these other Agile approaches way before it was called Agile, actually. They were called iterative approaches. The word Agile didn't pick up until the Agile Manifesto was written. That's where the word Agile came from. And basically, they were sort of in doubt whether to call it Agile or Adaptive. And I would have liked the other one, but I wasn't there, so they didn't know me. So anyway, so basically for a long time, when I started evangelizing Agile, and I've stopped doing that like a decade ago, and I also explained that to you, I got this cartoon, this Dilbert cartoon and different cartoons in my mailbox. And this is basically what a lot of people thought that Agile was, right? Where we don't do any planning anymore, we don't do any documentation, we'll just write code and complain afterwards and see what happens and stuff like that. And that is how a lot of people conceived Agile. And it's nothing like that. But this is not a talk about how Agile works. That would be too basic. And you would need training courses to do a two-day training course and then get a certificate or something. I don't hand out certificates, so I'm going to talk about what I think has happened to Agile in the meantime. And one of the things that has happened to Agile in the meantime is that these communities, these Agile communities, sort of got away with it. And they let everybody in from outside of the field, right? I'm a developer. I like Agile because I want to write code in a good way, right? That's why I like extreme programming, because it has all the technical practices in there. Not like Scrum, that sort of doesn't have anything in there, right? You can actually read the Scrum guide while sitting at this talk. It's like 16 pages. That's it, right? There's no way you can run projects based on 16 pages. You have to do more. I'll explain a bit about that. But what happened is that people took it and went all sorts of directions. And I got this quote from a guy from Australia. He says, Agile alone won't change organizations. For that, we need other ideas like blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what do you mean Agile alone won't change organizations? It was never intended to change organizations. It was meant to write better software, maybe faster, but more usable to the client. That's what it was for, right? So if you look at what has happened is that some of these guys who were signing the Agile Manifesto, and they were like, oh, crap, I hate Agile. Agile is dead. Now, you wouldn't like that, right? Agile is dead, because you're all an Agile project, and you would say, what do you mean it's dead? Well, basically, because they took it in all sorts of directions, other than just to write better code. And I'll show you some of the examples from Agile conferences. So if you go to Agile conferences, which I stopped doing, more or less, they have these horrible sessions in there. It's nothing like Microsoft Tech Days, right? And Dave Thomas says, well, Basically, because I didn't think that any of these things were in the spirit of the manifesto we produced. Now look at the program of an Agile conference. This is one. I think it happened in Brussels like 2 years ago. There are sessions in there that have nothing to do with what I call Agile, right? It's like the multi-level feedback cycle. I believe I can draw. My kids can do that. Like, whatever. The wisdom of the Enneagram. Discover and evolve your personality type. What on earth does that have to do with writing code? Well, you could, of course, link it, but you could link everything to writing code, right? Some more, like management is dead, hooray. Improve using the improvement kata for retrospectives. Small controlled experiments. That's much more like 50 Shades of Grey or something, right? What else? Soyez très performant et innovant grâce à désordre. So being more performant basically because of chaos. Sounds cool, right? And there's more. There's like evidence-based management. Now that's a change. Or my product is a James Bond movie. James wants to be an Harvey. So I really don't know what to do with this. And I got, it's like people took it and went off to change the world, right? To improve the world. And there's nothing wrong with improving the world, but not on my watch. Because I want to write code, right? I'm a developer. That's what we do. So I call this the Agile hippies. Look at the quotes I got from tweets from Agile conferences. Like, make sure you don't miss the Agile elephant versus the waterfall elephant in the lobby. I really don't. During the session, we're going to discuss the happiness index of projects. What? Add ready for celebration before the done column on your Kanban board. I don't want to do this. Or this speaker. I sort of anonymized him because you don't want to know. I don't even know anymore who this guy is. But you look at, he's a speaker at an Agile conference. Look at what he did, right? He invented several unique techniques. Influence mandalas. Influence maps, supplication, exit and reentry. I guess we're back at 50 Shades again. And a language of, he even invented the interview. I thought we had interviews for a long time, but he invented them, right? He even invented cereal boxes. Now, I'm not really sure what that has to do with code. So they sort of took it and went to change the world. And in my opinion, this manifesto was actually meant to write software, guys, not to change the world. So I'm really happy. If you want to change the world, go out and do that. And I even might come and join you, but not on a project, right? This is for doing software better. So next step is, I told you, how do I do this without getting stabbed in the parking lot afterwards? Like, how do I get away with this? Well, basically, let me explain you one thing. So who of you is doing karate or jiu-jitsu or something? Anybody? So if you want to become, unless you're in the Karate Kid movie, if you want to become a black belt at karate, for instance, how many years of practice does that take? 10? Well, at least, right? So, to be honest, my girlfriend, I asked her, and she is a former Dutch champion in karate. She said, well, it takes at least 10 years, like 10, 12, maybe something like that, before you're even experienced to do that. And it takes a lot and a lot of practice. So before you are a karate master, it takes a lot of experience and a lot of practice and a lot of doing it. So, to become a scrum master, what does that take? 2 days. 2 days, right? And then you take an exam. It's a multiple choice exam, takes 30 minutes, and then you are a true scrum master. Now, isn't that good? Now, I'll tell you what the problem is with these scrum masters is many of these people come from outside of software development. So I did this talk as a keynote at a conference in Ukraine, and they got mad at me, basically because in the Ukraine, and in most of Eastern Europe, actually, I figured out, the Scrum Master role is a role that somebody from the team picks up additionally to his own role, doing real work. In Western Europe, and in the Netherlands especially, it's much more like you can actually hire a Scrum Master who does that full time, who doesn't do anything else outside Scrum Mastery, whatever you might call it, right? And the thing is, you could be a psychologist or a history teacher or whatever, a gardener for that matter, take the course and become a Scrum Master. And people hire you, actually. Now, the problem is, if you hire people that don't have any experience in Agile projects, they will do this. I call this dogmatic agile. They will apply, especially when Scrum. So I have nothing against Scrum, but I have something against people being put into projects and saying, oh, go out and solve every problem we have in this project, because we don't know how to do it. And that is really tough if you don't have any experience in doing those projects, right? And they'll do it very dogmatically. Like, I'll read the definition from Wikipedia. It's an established belief or doctrine held by a religion. So this is agile, right? A religion is like scrum.org, for instance. Or a particular group or organization, which is probably the other one. It's authoritative and not to be disputed, doubted, or diverged from by the practitioners or believers. Basically, this means people will go out and do Scrum exactly as it is described in the Scrum Guide. So when I worked for Capgemini, I used to do, let's say, sort of audits to projects, like and try to help projects that are failing on get underway, and I flew around the world doing that. And I got into this project in Brussels, and that was really failing. And they were building software for a nuclear agency, sort of interesting stuff. And so I said, well, so what's wrong? And they said, well, the client doesn't want to accept our software. And I said, why not? And the project manager said, well, basically, we don't have acceptance criteria. I'm like, okay, weird. And I said, why not? He said, well, basically, the Scrum Master says that in the Scrum Guide, there's no acceptance criteria. Which is true, by the way. It doesn't mean you don't have to have them, right? They're really good to have. And then I said to him, please show me your project plan. That's something you do if you do go out and do an audit. First thing you do is ask for the project plan, right? And then ask for the software architect document, which is usually also not there. So I asked him for the project plan, and he said, well, we didn't have one. I'm like, okay. And he said, why not? And he said, because the Scrum Master says there's no project plan in the Scrum Guide. And there isn't. Also, the word project manager is not mentioned in the Scrum Guide. The word user story is not mentioned in the Scrum Guide. Right? So there's lots of stuff not in the Scrum Guide, and you have to be able to see that there's other stuff you need to do outside of implementing Scrum. But it's a bit like this, right? I had these discussions with Scrum Masters all over the world, like, no, you cannot do use case modeling in an agile project. Why not? It's not in the Scrum Guide. Who cares? It works for us, right? You have to figure out for yourself how agile fits you. It's not the other way around. You don't have to go out and check whether your organization fits Scrum, which it probably doesn't, because you do it a lot more than is in the Scrum Guide. You have to figure out how it works for you. And watch out with these Scrum guys that you hire, because some of them are not able to solve everything, right? If you get them really cheaply, like, oh, they only take like 60 euros an hour, or whatever, I don't know what the rates are for those persons, be aware that they might be not as experienced as you hope. Of course, lots of them are already. So this is basically what it's about, right? If you think it's expensive to hire a professional, wait until you hire an amateur. So the next step. So as we are writing code, many managers will actually use metaphors that come out of construction or building cars, right? They want to have a software assembly line because they think every piece of software that we build is exactly the same as the previous one, and it never is. Every piece of software that we build is different from the previous ones. That is why software will not come out of an assembly line. Also, construction, like, you know what, it's like building a house. First you build the first floor, and then the second floor. It's usually a motivation to do waterfall. Project managers are really happy with it. And there's lots of differences in there, and I'll show you a bit of these differences, right? So to give you an example, what if a project manager comes up to you and says, so how long does it take you to build this particular feature? What kind of answers do you give, right? Give me an answer. 2 weeks. Sounds good. Oh, you need more information. I don't have more information. I'm a project manager. I don't have a clue anyway. So sorry for those of you who are project manager. I humbly excuse myself for that. So the thing is, we are used to giving of numbers. But the question is, how accurate are these? Has anybody of you actually seen estimates that make any sense? I never have, right? And I'm in this field for more than 2 decades. I once did an estimate for a project. I just counted the number of pages and multiplied by the number of tables in the data model. I was like, okay, it's that kind of those numbers, those actually are good. So it's like 1,200 hours. And much to my surprise, they actually matched. So I kept that. So keep that in mind if you want to do estimates. Most of us will give off a number, like, I don't know, 20 hours or 2 weeks, as you said, right? This is an absolute number, right? So whose 2 weeks are those? Are those my 2 weeks, your 2 weeks, the tester's 2 weeks? What is it? And the thing is also that if we give off those numbers, project managers will say, oh, you get 20 hours for that. After 20 hours, they will come up to you and say, why isn't it finished yet? The difference is you have probably given off an average. They think it's the upper level. It's the upper estimate, like, oh, I don't need more than 20 hours. And you were saying, oh, no, on average, I need 20 hours. So that's when we figured out in Agile that it's much better to do story points or whatever kind of points you have. Pizza points, function points, smart use case points, story points. I really don't care. Like, it's like 5.487. And that's good, right? Because it has a decimal point in it. Managers will actually believe this, right? Because it's very accurate. And my suggestion is, in many of those Agile projects, what you see is at the start of this iteration, or sprint if you want, people go sit in a room for about a day and talk about the stories they want to pick up, break them down into tasks, and estimate those in points or whatever you do. And my suggestion is, stop doing that. It doesn't make any sense. The thing is, there is something which is called the law of large numbers. And that works to your benefit. The law of large numbers basically says it's a principle of probability according to which the frequencies of events with the same likelihood of occurrence even out, which is very important, given enough trials or instances. So basically the law of large numbers says if you have enough items to estimate, it doesn't really matter if you estimate them on a scale from 1 to 10 or the Fibonacci numbers or whatever scale you're using. Because you could just, you might as well say, I'm going to give them all a 1. What I do is I give them a 1 or it's too big. That's it. And because you have so many stories in your project or use cases or tasks or whatever you do, it doesn't make any sense to do more work on estimation than that. Because I'll show you in later slides that the thing is, you are never accurate with those estimates. A lot of people estimate the amount of work they want to put into the sprint. But as any sprint is different, because somebody's ill, or this has more complexity, or whatever you might have, or suddenly the CEO wants a demo, which takes up a lot of time, none of these sprints will actually be the same. So it doesn't make any sense to procrastinate these next few iterations. Just name all of your stories one, and it saves you loads and loads of time. Keep that in mind, please. So. And then we are using the wrong metaphors, right? We are actually saying, how long does it take us to build this particular feature? And that doesn't really matter, actually, because this is not engineering as mechanical engineering or building construction or building cars, which is repetitive. It's very different than that. So please go out to your project managers and make them stop using those metaphors. I found this quote on the internet. Unfortunately, I don't know anymore who said it, but it's actually pretty accurate. This guy says, or girl, I don't know anymore, coding is a creative problem. That is basically where project managers go off. They don't consider coding to be a creative problem. They consider it to be repetitive, which it is not. You all know that, right? Every time a developer writes code, he has taken a non-deterministic path towards an unknown solution. That's what we do. That is why writing code is so much fun. And I've been writing code since 1985, guys. So it remains fun, even after 30 years. A unique solution that has never been created before. If the work weren't unique, he wouldn't need to write it. He could simply copy and paste it, which is not the case. So therefore, stop using these stupid metaphors. Next one. Self-organization. Who of you is in a self-organized or self-steering team? It's improving, right? It's good. Now, I work for this insurance, used to work for this insurance company, and they had this very interesting organizational chart, in which case you don't get any work done. This is like the CEO, right? And this is the rest of the organization. They don't really matter. In that case, you're well, anyway. So in that case, you'll do something which I call CDD. Ever heard of it? It's called CEO-driven development. Because you just do anything the CEO asks you to do. In other occasions, you might want to go into sort of self-steering teams, right? Oh, yeah, I'll give you one example of that. The CEO of this particular company, he was into everything, like he was micromanaging everything. At one point in time, he said, you know what? If two developers on two teams are working on the same file, and one of them checks it in and the other one checks in afterwards, they'll probably no one, he's a bit arrogant, probably no one in the software field ever figured out the fact that if you do that, you'll lose the changes of the first guy. And I said to him, yeah, well, he sort of invented distributed version control systems in the 80s and stuff like that. And he said, no, I want to be able to take care of that. He said, you know what, we'll have four teams that write code, and they'll get a check-in quarter. Every team get 15 minutes to check in their code, and then the next team can go along. So you have to wait another hour before you can check in your code. That was his idea. We sort of improved it. We sort of created the check-in hat. Like the guy who's wearing the hat is allowed to check in and the rest of them isn't, just to make fun of it. This is horrible. I felt like, you know, Willy Wonka with all the Oompa Loompas and stuff. And that was really horrible. And so this guy was into everything. Other than that, self-steering teams are great. The only problem is, for most people, being a self-steering team is way out of the comfort zone, right? They have to make decisions. Not everybody likes to do that, right? And the question is, nobody can tell you how to get to self-steering teams. It's a bit like this, right? You can say, oh, yeah, you know, how do you draw an owl? Well, you create two circles, and then you draw the rest of the owl. Just go out and figure it out yourselves. And it's a bit tough, right? To me, being in a team, so if I work with teams, and I do that all the time, is the most fun I have in teams is when I can blindly trust my other teammates, right? I used to work in a team, and I sold my house, and it was way underwater, so I had to borrow money, and he borrowed me. Just from that, he borrowed me 10,000 euros. Was a guy on my team. So we sort of blindly trusted each other, right? And that is the way self-steering teams. If you have that sort of trust, you know you can do everything, right? That's the way to get stuff working. You have to figure out how to get trust in your teammates. Not just working with them, but trust them blindly. And that is when you see when teams are the most effective. Way more than any team with any project manager could do. Now the next thing is, I'm running slightly on schedule. The thing is, to do that, you have to allow your team to learn continuously. And that learning never stops. That is basically the heart of Agile. It is you never stop learning, right? There's retrospectives at the end of every iteration. And they're not there for nothing, right? They're there to allow you to learn and improve on what you're doing. Make use of that. Even though retrospectives are totally boring, there's lots of games to do that with, but anyway, they're totally boring, but you have to learn from them. And you have to improve yourself continuously. Now, the thing is, what most managers think is that learning is a linear process as well. Managers think everything's linear, by the way. No, I'm not going to make dirty jokes now. I could. But no. No, anyway, so you have to allow to do that. But the thing is, it's not linear. So there's a book called Becoming a Technical Leader by a guy called Jerry Weinberg, and it has a brilliant metaphor for learning in it. He was trying to teach himself how to play pinball on a certain machine, and his assumption was that he could linearly become better at it. And what he figured out, once he started doing that it was much more like this. You recognize these things, right? You recognize these points. It's when you learn something totally new that changes your perspective on anything you do. Like in his case, at some point in time, he started, he was on this pinball machine that had a multiple thing in it. So at some point in time, he got multiple balls. Did you ever play pinball with multiple balls? It's horrible, right? At first, when you started doing that, it's like, I have to keep all of these balls into play, right? And it doesn't work because they bounce off each other and suddenly they're all gone. Those of you who've played pinball before know this, right? And he said, you know what I'll do? I'll just try to keep my eyes on one of these balls and just forget the other ones. And if they pop by, I just hit them, but that's it, right? So at the end, after all these other balls were gone, he still had the one that he was looking at. And that was sort of an epiphany, let's call it an epiphany, that actually improved his play, right? And it doesn't go linear. It's like all of a sudden you have this epiphany. And then people are like, oh, yeah, that's true. You recognize that, right? You learn something new, like I learned how to write more functional code in Java just a year ago. You can actually, they now have lambda expressions in Java. Hooray. Took them a long time. Anyway, so so you learn to get better, but it happens on these occasions. And the thing is, what is most important about this is that it doesn't go even like that. it goes a bit like that. So he monitored all the scores he had, and he noticed that just before getting better at something, he got worse at first. And you'll recognize this. If you think of your own experience, and it doesn't really matter, it's about programming, about modeling, about whatever you do about Agile, you get these, you start doing these small experiments. Maybe that was this talk about on this Agile conference, but you start doing stuff and you fail at it first. You recognize that, right? Your builds break, your colleagues get annoyed, stuff like that. The testers go out furious, and then all of a sudden you figure it out. And then you get way better at it. Now, this is actually how it works. So you have to allow yourself to fail. Failing is actually good if you do it fast. So you'll learn a lot from it, right? So keep that in mind. So basically, the loop looks much more like this. And you have to allow yourself to fail to be able to learn and get to the next level. It's the same with playing games, by the way. It just works exactly the same way. So the next thing is, I'm going to talk about sprints a little bit. The thing is, none of you is Usain Bolt. At least I don't see him, but he's probably not coming to an Agile talk, right? He probably should, but anyway. So if you look at sprints, the idea of having this two-week thing, and you figure out at the start of this thing how much work you can do during these 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever you might have, and then at the end, present a sort of potentially shippable product increment, as it's officially called. That is really tough, right? Because you have to estimate here how much work you can do. And as I said, we are not good at estimation, right? We suck at it. So basically what will happen is something like this. I took this off a real project, basically what they did is sort of estimated all the work at the start of the sprint and then started doing work, and at the end of the sprint, they still had some work left. And they were like, we couldn't get our work done. We suck at it, or we're bad at estimation, probably both. Or maybe somebody just got ill, right? And you had to do all the work with one guy less or one girl less. So the thing is, this is very hard to do. The next sprint they had, exactly the same. And the sprint after that too. And then the fourth sprint after that as well. And the fifth and the sixth. And now they got into trouble, right? Because they didn't finish all the work six sprints long. And the project manager was like, you're losers. He literally said that. Of course they weren't losers. They were just not good at estimating software development work, which is very tough to do. So my suggestion here is stop doing that. Stop going to the front and trying to estimate all this work, because you will probably not be able to estimate it exactly what happens. And the thing is, you don't need that. You don't need all these prep sessions at the start of an iteration, which are called differently in every Agile approach you have. You just could say, you know what we'll do? We'll just figure out this is our backlog, and we'll just, as soon as we've finished one, we'll pick up the next one. And it doesn't really matter when it's finished, because you don't have to do the demo only at the end of a project. I got into a discussion last week. I said, yeah, but even if we're finished, like in day three with something, we can only do the demo at the end of 2 weeks, or they have 4 week iterations, it got even worse. Well, you can do the demo just right away, right? Just get everybody in the room, do the demo, done. You can do it basically every day. There's no reason why you should. Why you shouldn't, actually. So basically what I'm saying is here, stop doing all these prep sessions and take them off one by one. Now, if you do that, you'll get to the next step, is that if you're using these typical Scrum boards, and I read a lot of these blog posts, that people explaining the way a Scrum board works, or task board as it's called, it's like, oh, you have stuff that is hanging in the to-do column. Oh, I have another example. To-do, in progress, and done. You know these boards, right? You've seen them. Who uses these boards like this? Stop doing that. The problem with these boards is that most of the time, and there's here, there's only two items, or three maybe, but most of the time, there's like 20 of them in here, right? Who of you has more than 20 in this particular column in progress? Well, you're not, well, nobody, of course, is going to say that. But anyway, the problem is, you don't see the progress. They're in progress, but nobody knows how far you are. And they're supposedly to be small enough to be able to manage that. But if you look at a board and there's like a whole cloud of stuff, you could say you're doing cloud computing. So if there's a cloud of stuff in the middle, nobody knows where you are in the project. So my suggestion is, start looking at the types of work you do. And put that on a board. And your board will look a bit like this. This is just an example from one of my projects. It says, oh, there's, and you don't have to do this exact same thing. It sort of depends on what you guys are doing in your projects. Like, there's stuff in preparation. We'll probably pick that up later on. Stuff that we still need to do. Stuff that we're working on. So this is developer stuff, right? And design probably. And then we do developer testing, and then we go into real testing. And then acceptance testing, rework, and accepted. And sometimes we skip the rework, hopefully. And it goes into the accepted column, right? So we move the items from left to right on the board, or left to right like that for you. And you can always see immediately where the trouble is. So where's the trouble in this particular board? Testing, right? It's always the same. That's why there's only one tester here in the room. It's him, guys. And and it's not because they're to blame. You know what happened in this particular case? Is that the tester on my team, his wife gave birth the week before. So he wasn't there, right? And we as developers, we just kept on pushing out stuff into the test column, right? We were good. We're just chunking out more code and more code and more code until he came back and he found the board like this. I should have much better taken a picture of his face when he looked at the board for the first time. He was like, what? And we were like, oh no, this is basically our fault. We just put too much work in the testing column. And you could disallow you to do that. If you look at stuff like, if you add work in progress limits on your, it's a horrible abbreviation, it's like WIP limits. Doesn't work in Dutch. So put limits on it, saying, oh, we cannot have more than four items at the same time in the test column. That means if I want to put something to the test column, something has to go out first. That means we can put our focus as a team, as this ideally self-steering team, on testing first before we put other stuff into the build, into the test column, right? And it works very differently than these Scrum boards. So try and move away from these Scrum boards. So there's two more. Now the thing with Agile is, you're all in different projects, and they are different by nature, right? They're not the same. That means there is no such thing as a one-size-fits Agile. There's no approach out there, especially not Scrum, because Scrum is a very limited approach, which is very good. You could say it's just a framework, and you put in all the practices from XP and from Kanban into it, and it works much better. But you have to figure out yourself how it works for you. Now, basically, it says individuals and interactions over processes and tools in the Agile Manifesto. That doesn't mean you cannot have any process. Most of you will have, might be very minimal, but you will have some sort of process in place. And that's not a bad thing. Don't let people tell you that you cannot have a process or you cannot use whatever tool you're using. If you want to use Visual Studio ReSharper, good. If you want to use Rider as an IDE or Visual Studio Code, whatever. If you want to do modeling in your project, use a real modeling tool. Think of Enterprise Architect, something like that. Please do that. There's no rules in there that say you cannot do something or you have to do something. They're just not there. Now, one other item I need to touch is that about enterprise agile. Oh, I hate that word. I talked at an enterprise agile conference in Brussels last year, and I was like, what am I doing here, right? The problem with it is that managers way up in the organization will say, oh, we have to go and do agile. And then they figure out there's something like this. This management, right? This is management talk. This is the way management wants to do agile. I really haven't got a clue how this stuff works. It's horrible. Most of these organizations haven't done any successful Agile project whatsoever, not even with a five-person team. So if you're not good at doing Agile with a five-person team, what's the point in having Enterprise Agile? Please, start off small, right? It's like a ripple effect. It's like, start off here with one team. I did have a particular client of ours, of mine that I was working with, and they hadn't done Agile before. This is like 6-7 years ago. So we started off with one team, and we looked at people that were probably getting enthusiastic about Agile if you started doing it. And we put them in the team. And they started doing stand-up meetings, and they started doing boards, and they started doing breakdowns and burn down charts and stuff like that, and retrospectives. And people actually came in and looked at it. They were like, what are you guys doing? And then we said, it's called a stand-up meeting. So what is it for, right? Well, it's just to be able to see that what we're doing. And they were like, And then you saw, if you walk down the corridors of that building, more and more teams started doing that, right? And that's pretty cool. And then you can go in and say, you know what, if you do this, you might want to try this as well. And like, oh, cool, we can have a board too. Like, if you're the marketing department, yes, you can have a board too. oh, that's cool. We're going to get our post-its from the whatever office. Stuff like that. And it has to be, it has to ripple out, right? It's just the way Agile works. And be aware of this. Go out to your managers and please say, there's no such thing as a best practice. There's not something that works for everybody. Scrum works sort of because it's a sort of almost empty framework. But all of the other practices sometimes work for you, sometimes they don't. That doesn't really matter. You have to figure out the process that is most effective to you guys, right? Now the last thing. Now this is probably the most weirdest thing I'm going to tell. Lesson 10 would be stop doing projects. Now I have like 17 seconds to explain, so I will go like 5 minutes overtime. I'll try to do it quickly. So here's the idea of a project. This comes out of this is a quote from Alan Kelly, a guy I know, and he says, well, basically most of the projects that we do, the project model has some assumptions, like we can sort of estimate what the benefit of a project is at the start, right? And we can sort of figure out how much time, money, and resources, usually managers then mean people, right? Or others, the resources could be computers, but they're usually people. And they have to figure out how much of these you need to finish this project. Now the problem with that is that usually we are doing way too much. I'll skip the next slide, and I'll go to this one. Have you seen this picture before? This one sort of changed my perspective when I first saw it at Software Development. The thing is, if you do a project, and a friend of mine who's a project manager, I'm still trying to get rid of him on Facebook because I don't want any project managers in my friends, and no, he's a nice guy. He's from Brabant, that tells you a lot, right? So anyway, he sort of put this post up on Facebook and he said, oh, we just finished the next successful project at some client. I said, so what'd you do? He said, well, we finished on time, on budget, and the required functionality. And so I'm successful. And I'm like, how do you know? How do you know that you couldn't have done the same project in half the time? He said, because this was in the plan, so it's successful. So what if you could do it for half the money? And you could, probably. Because we are always building way too much. You all know that, right? We're building stuff that nobody needs. And we as developers, we're always complaining, like, why am I building this? Nobody will use it. And that's true for most of the stuff we build, actually, which is waste. Now, the thing is, you could say, let's say I'm going to need 20 features in my next product. And all of these features I could implement, right? It takes me a lot of time. I could create a project plan, whatever. But I could also say, I start off with the first feature. And I'm going to say to my client, you know what? I can build a very simple, straightforward version of this. Or I can build you the fully functional stuff with everything and all of the menus that, for instance, Microsoft Office has. And I don't know what to do with all these features. But I could also build a very simple one, like a skateboard version of your feature. And then after we've done that, we could go to the next feature, and you could say, what kind of version do you want of this feature? Maybe also a skateboard version. Maybe the bicycle version. Some luxury added to it. And if you do that with every feature, you'll probably end up at the end of when you finished all the 20 features, which is usually a lot earlier than you would do for a whole project, you could say, maybe I now have like 12 skateboards, 6 bicycles, and two brommers. I don't know what the English word for Brommer is. There probably is one, but so it's a much less rich, feature-rich thing, which still does the work. Now that thing is called a minimal viable product. So if you start working on minimal viable products instead of doing projects, you'll be cheaper, you'll be done faster, and you need less resources, people, right? And so basically you start working on a roadmap instead of a project plan. And that changes your world. Because in that case, if you could agree on this with your clients, when they're in your own company, it's easier than when they're outside of your company. But you can do this. And that means that the traditional metaphor for projects, you don't need that anymore. Now, that would save a whole lot of money and time and frustration in our field, right? And my suggestion is, move away from this metaphor of doing projects with fixed budget, fixed price, and fixed whatever they have, which isn't fixed. Because it's not the right metaphor for building software. It's a wrong metaphor. So I'll wrap it up for you. Basically, it's about this. It's about growth. It's about learning. And that is not easy. But learning new stuff is always preferable, I would say, to staying in the same location where you are, chunk out the same types of code every time again and again. Do not innovate stuff like that. So go out and this is basically my favorite one. It's actually saying, let's go exploring. That is what software development is about, right? It's about learning new stuff every day. That's why I love it. Done.